It's time for Twit This Week in Tech. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Do not listen to this show while driving. I want you to put your thinking caps on. I have two of the smartest people we ever have had on the network. Two of my favorite guests. Amy Webb's here. Cory Doctorow's here. I've been trying to get these two together. We are going to talk about privacy, big tech, what we can do about it, what we should do about it, the role of artists, the role of intellectuals. This is going to be a wild ride. Fasten your seatbelts. Twit is next. This Week in Tech comes to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company does not have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twit, This Week in Tech, episode 793, recorded Sunday, October 18th, 2020, the J2J Protocol. This episode of This Week in Tech is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click for 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. Go to expressvpn.com/twit. And by ExtraHop. ExtraHop helps you keep your business secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. Learn more about how ExtraHop stops breaches 70% faster and experience a free trial for yourself at extrahop.com/twit. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at 1/5 the price of Amazon S3. And faster than the competition, with no fees for egress or API requests, and no complex storage tiers. Start your free trial at wasabi.com. And please, don't forget to use the offer code TWIT. It's time for Twit This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the week's news in technology. Stand back, kids. This is one for the ages. You're going to want to put your thinking caps on because I have the two smartest people I know in the room. Well, they're not. They're only figuratively in the room. They're in their own rooms because, you know, nobody can be in the same room with me anymore, apparently. Joining us right now from the Future Today Institute, the wonderful Amy Webb. It's great to see you. AmyWebb.io.
Hey. Hey, Leo.
The Signals Are Talking, her book about being a futurist. Her latest, the Gang of Five? No, what is the name of the...
No, Big Nine.
The Big Nine. There's nine, not five. What am I saying? The Big Nine, and soon a microbiology, or not micro, what kind of biology?
Synthetic. It's a book about the futures of synthetic biology. It's called Rewriting Life.
That's why it should not be called Rewriting Life, because you can't say it.
It's hard to say.
No, I like it. Rewriting Life is good. Just practice. Big Nine is currently out and available everywhere. And Amy's been on Triangulation a couple of times. So has this guy, Cory Doctorow, who is the author of too many books to count. Welcome. His new site is pluralistic.net. This is the new one, Attack Surface. And he's doing something very unusual with this. He's doing the audiobook via Kickstarter. Why is that, Cory? Welcome, by the way.
Have done, I should say.
Is it over?
The Kickstarter is over, yeah. Did very well, $270,000.
Wow.
So as a doctrinal matter, don't allow DRM on my work. There is one company that dominates the audiobook market, Audible, and they have a mandatory DRM requirement.
Right.
They say that that's there to protect us authors. And of course, if you want to remove the DRM from an Audible book, you just type into your favorite search engine.
It's very easy.
DRM. Yeah. But yeah. Under Section 12.1 of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it's a felony punishable by a 5-year prison sentence and a $500,000 fine to tell someone how to remove their DRM. And so what that means is that I, as the author, if I sell you an audiobook on Audible, I'm locking you to Audible's platform forever, and I can't authorize you to take my work and leave it. So if I ever get into a situation where I feel like Amazon's offering me a deal I don't want to take, and I try to go to one of its rivals, you have to surrender your books to come follow me somewhere else or maintain two separate and parallel sets of infrastructure to do it. So this is terrible and I don't like it. Amazon promised they would drop Audible's DRM when they bought Audible in 2008. I've been waiting for 12 years. I'm not holding my breath anymore. And, you know, my publishers, Macmillan, they're very nice people, but they had the very sensible position that if I wouldn't allow them to sell my audiobooks in the place where 90% of the customers were, they didn't want to pay me for those rights. And I was like, that is perfectly fair. And they said, but you can keep them and you can make your own audiobook.
That's very generous.
So I did. So I went out. I got Amber Benson, who you may know as Tara from Buffy, but she's also a brilliant novelist. I got her to record it at Skyboat Media, which is a tremendous audiobook studio here in Southern California. And we had my sound editor, John Taylor Williams, who's been editing my stuff for 15 years, do the edit. And I pre-sold it on Kickstarter. Along with the ebook, which I sell on behalf of my publisher. So if you buy it for me, I give Macmillan 70%. I take the 30% Jeff Bezos would normally get. And then my publisher takes 25% of that, which is the author's share, and sends it back to me as a royalty. Comes out to like 48.5%, which is a great
bad.
Way to go. So
that's not bad. Yeah.
So I sold it. I sold the first two audiobooks. I sold all three ebooks. I sold the new audiobook. And all together, we raised $270,000, including three $10,000 pledges for commissions to write new Little Brother short stories, which are going to be the nucleus of a new short story collection. So I got another book out of it as well.
Nice. This newest Attack Surface is the third in the Little Brother series.
Yeah.
And
it's a
highly
book for adults.
Highly recommended. So that's Thank good. You. So if people want the audiobook, do they go to the Kickstarter page or is there somewhere else?
No, that window has closed. So that was your $15 pre-order price. Now it's a $25 audiobook that now that the pre-order advance price is over. And you can get that. It's an Audible exclusive, which is to say it's exclusive of Audible. You can get anywhere that is an Audible.
You recommended last time you were on Libro.fm, which gives a little kickback to your local bookstore. I chose Copperfields, my local bookstore. So that's kind of a nice feeling when you
I have a bookstore at craphound.com/shop.
Oh, good.
Where you can buy all of my audiobooks and all of my ebooks. And again, it's that deal where I get Jeff Bezos's cut. And then my publisher sends me back my royalty.
It's only fair that you should get Jeff Bezos's cut.
I promise to use it in ways that are more sensible than he does. He says he doesn't know what to do with his money. He'll have to do space exploration. And I have ideas for what he could do with his money. And if you give that money to me, I will spend it accordingly.
Craphound.com, amyweb.io. And now that ends the show. So thank you I have a lot more to talk about. I don't know where to start. Normally, you know, we would talk about the iPhone event. But when I have two big minds, big brains here like this, that seems kind of trivial to talk about. I want to talk actually about the story you put in Slate this week, Corey, if you don't mind. Because it kind of rang a bell with me. It kind of hit home. The dangers of cynical sci-fi disaster stories. It seems like that's all we're seeing these days. And certainly if you're watching a sci-fi on TV, on Amazon Prime or Netflix or HBO Max, it's dystopia as far as the eye can see. You've written your share of cynical sci-fi disaster stories. Why are you going to stop?
Well, I would say that I have written my share of cynical sci-fi disasters, if not the whole story was cynical. I tend to be a pretty idealistic and optimistic or at least hopeful person. I, like everybody, really enjoy a zombie apocalypse story. Mm-hmm. There is something really exciting.
We're living in it.
Yeah. Sure. Yes. And, you know, I'm a pulp writer. I write science fiction. I'm a pulp reader. I read science fiction. That means I like a lot of plot in my fiction. And usually, you know, the two plots are person versus nature
conflict.
And person versus person.
Yeah.
And if you're trying to like really lean into the plot, you could do person versus nature versus person. And that's the story where like the tsunami knocks your house down, your neighbors come over to eat you.
Yeah.
And
there you go.
Those stories I've really enjoyed. That there's so many of those that I've read that I've enjoyed. And a little brother actually opens with a scene like that where they're in after a terrorist attack, they're down in a BART station and someone just randomly stabs someone else just because they can.
Oh God.
And I think the problem with that is twofold. One is like a verisimilitude problem. Or actually, let's call it threefold. One's a verisimilitude problem because generally we're pretty good to each other. You know, Rebecca Solnit's history of disasters, Paradise Built in Hell, very closely researched history of just people being really kind to each other and really stepping up during disasters, and of the countervailing force, which is not humanity's cruelty, but rather what she calls elite panic, the conviction on the part of wealthy people that when the lights go out, the poor are coming for them. And so this preemptive strike, you know, you may remember like Blackwater mercenaries shooting people in New Orleans after the hurricane, that sort of preemptive reaction, you know, getting your revenge in first, is really what turns crises into catastrophes. And so it's wrong. It's also the wrong intuition pump that, you know, when crisis strikes and we have to make a very quick decision about what's going to go on, we lean on the things that are most easy to imagine. And if every time you have seen a story about a disaster, you've been primed to believe that this is the time when your neighbor is coming over with a shotgun, you would be an idiot to like take the thawing food in your freezer, make a stew and go over to your neighbor's house with a covered dish. But if you think that they're coming over with a covered dish, then everybody's good, right? Everybody shares. And that's how you get started. Because, of course, the answer to a disaster is not a total war of all against all, right? The answer to a disaster is like getting the sanitation running again and figuring out how to distribute masks.
It kind of feels like we're in that crux right now where we could go either way.
It sure feels like it. It really does. And then that's the last part, is that it's bad art because – you know, there are lots of ways that people of goodwill can disagree with each other in ways that are irreconcilable and that can make for stories that are really tense and really good, really plot driven, but that are truer to our human nature, which is that, you know, for the most part, people are good and want to help, but they may have a genuinely irreconcilable difference about what that help amounts to. So, you know, Attack Surface is a book about this young woman, Masha, who lives through the terrorist attack that is the inciting incident in Little Brother. And rather than becoming an opponent of the DHS, becomes a helper of the DHS to try and catch the terrorists. She then ends up in the second book working in a forward operations base in Iraq as a beltway bandit hunting jihadis. And when we meet her in the third book, she's just gone full on cyber mercenary, and she's working for a company much like Palantir or the NSO group, helping post-Soviet dictators crush pro-democracy movements. And she has to tell herself a story about why this is all okay. And that story is slowly collapsing, and she has to do more and more extreme things. And eventually the story collapses. She ends up back in San Francisco, no longer employed doing this. And she discovers to her horror that her childhood best friend, who's now an activist and a successor movement to the Movement for Black Lives, is being targeted with the same cyber weapons that she spent her career developing. And she has to like work out what it means to tell a story in which she's a good person when she can still see the blowback, and what she's going to do next to redeem herself. And, you know, I think that that's a much chewier, more interesting, higher stakes story, a story in which winning may involve permanently alienating yourself from people you like and who you want to be on the same side of. But there's no way that both of you can have it your way, and the issue matters so much that neither of you can give on it. That's a really tense, important, great, pulpy story. And it's a story that I'm you know, much more interested in reading these days, not least because it primes us to understand what it is our neighbors are doing when crisis hits and they have a different idea to our ideas about what we should do about it. Because we're in you know, the path of many crises to come, you know, and so we really do need to figure out what our intuition around our neighbors during crises should be. Otherwise, it could go, you know, much worse than even the negative projections that I think keep all of us at night up.
I can't wait to read it. It's really interesting. What a premise, right, Amy? I mean, that's deep. Do you, by the way, I don't know, I should have introduced you. Have you guys ever met before, Amy and?
We just met briefly beforehand.
Just now,
here.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think we are sort of oscillating around the same circles.
Yes.
Of other people, but we haven't met.
Well,
yet,
it's great to get you, the two of you together. What do you think about the new iPhone? Never mind. It's hopeless.
I like that they finally brought back the flip phone. That's cool.
Yeah. Go ahead, Amy. What?
No, I was just going to say, I'd love to pick up on the thread about dystopian futures. And just as a sort of reminder that we tend to go throughout history that the pendulum swings, and rarely does it fall in the center where we just have where we're satisfied with pragmatism. So in a sense, it's not strange to me that we've spent so long telling each other stories about utter, you know, horror stories, zombie apocalypses, you know, the dystopia somehow is getting darker and darker. I've been watching The Boys, the second season, and I'm not going to spoil. Well, you know, I got through that, whatever, second episode, and it was, I remember thinking, I did not get through this. Is kind of a strange name for a feminist character, right. But, you know, anyhow. So I was momentarily going to bed that night feeling like somewhat vindicated, and then obviously things take a real turn. Here's the point, though. I think we arrived in this place, not just in the stories that we tell, but the actual real world problems that we have, because it began with, a total utopian outlook, a utopian thinking.
Certainly the internet and technology. We really thought this was going to make the world a better place.
That's right. And the problem with, I think, anchoring ourselves in optimism or utopia is that we then fail to recognize that there can be also negative next order impacts when either you're not planning for real world issues, real world problems that could result, or you think that somehow everything will be okay. And I don't mean the sort of Norman Vincent Peale power of positive thinking, but I do think back to Wells, and at the turn of the century, you know, a lot of those early, very, very, very early science fiction writers were writing about utopia. They were writing about science and evidence-based utopia where everything would be amazing. And part of why everything was so amazing was because of eugenics.
Right? Yeah.
So, whoops. So I agree that maybe we don't need to continue. We need a better balance. But my concern is I watch us sort of go back and forth, and people who are writing about science and they're writing sci-fi or they're working in futures in the area of futures, it seems to be zero sum. And if we swing totally in the other direction, I think we wind up to some extent 20 years from now back at where we started.
Yeah, I have a complicated relationship with technological utopianism because it's a criticism that's often leveled at the sort of what you might call the digital rights community, that you know, back in the old days, we thought if we could just connect everybody, it would be fine. And then we failed to understand that it would end up like it did. And I do think that the digital rights community made some missteps, but I don't think that they were in failing to understand the potential risks of technology, right? Remember that organizations like the Electronic Frontier Foundation and the Free Software Foundation have their grounding not merely in aspirations for the kinds of self-realization and self-actualization and community that we could get with technology, but also in fear for what it would mean to have a technological society without them, right? What it would mean to have ubiquitous networks but no cryptography, so that universal surveillance would become a kind of commonplace of the future. That is what animates those movements. And if you think that the future will take care of itself, the technology is gonna sort out all the problems, you don't start an organization like Electronic Frontier Foundation. You just, you know, go off and do a startup or something, because it's all gonna take care of itself. It's, you know, this idea that Michael Weinberger had when he wrote this paper for Public Knowledge on 3D printing, which is it will all be so great if we don't screw it up. I really feel like that's the animating ideology of at least the digital rights world. But I do think that we did get one thing wrong, which is that we failed to understand that we had passed the heroic age of anti-monopoly enforcement. And we didn't understand exactly what that would mean. After all, if you got your first computer around the time of the IBM PC, you were enjoying a computer ecosystem in which the largest tech company in the history of the world was too frightened to bundle its own operating system with its flagship computer because it might attract antitrust attention. They had just gone through a 12-year antitrust enforcement action in which they had outspent the entire DOJ's budget for antitrust for all DOJ cases in that one case. Every year, IBM spent that much, and in which IBM had exercised forbearance when Tom Jennings, the brilliant computer engineer who also started FidoNet, reverse engineered the ROM and the PC for Phoenix Computers so that they could sell it to Dell and Gateway and all those other companies to make their own computers. And I think if you grew up with computers in that era, you quite naturally might have assumed that if a company became a monopolist that prevented the kind of dynamic turnover that was common in an era where one day AltaVista was on top and the next day was Yahoo, the next day was Google, that the DOJ might exercise some enforcement against them. And instead, you know, after Microsoft petered out, I still think the Microsoft case did some good, but after Microsoft petered out, that was it. We just let companies do the most nakedly anti-competitive stuff, you know, buy their competitors, merge with major competitors, create vertical monopolies, and end up in a world where, you know, the web is five giant websites filled with screenshots from the other four, and surveillance is ubiquitous, not least because states rely on private companies to gather the data that they then plunder for state surveillance. And so there's, you know, no hope of states curbing this surveillant impulse of tech companies for so long as they're a prime beneficiary of it.
Corey, I totally agree with you. However, when I hear the same argument being made, it is with reference to the current investigations, at least the ones being levied in the United States, where the calls tend to be, let's break up these companies. The challenge, mm-hmm. of course, is that, again, the mechanisms that we have for regulation were developed in a time when company structures were different and the IP that companies were producing weren't so deeply embedded into all of the rest of their operations. You know, the United States, as a lot of countries, you know, the U.S. doesn't have its own cloud. The federal government runs on AWS. The United States has stopped heavily investing in R&D and, quite frankly, not just within tech, but in science as well. Everybody cares much, much more about the D than the R. So with funding for basic science and research being stripped, the question that we have to ask ourselves is if we don't want these monopolies, which I think everybody at this point generally agrees that we do not, because today we're talking about tech, tomorrow it will be the frontiers of synthetic biology and other types of technologies. You know, the question is, how do we keep the research moving forward when we've essentially outsourced it to the private sector and engineer the future so that it looks different? And I think the problem is that we don't have we're not engaged in the right conversations. So it can't be as simple as we screwed up over the past 40 years. The way we're going to fix it is that the way we fixed it before, which is through the traditional antitrust and anti-competitiveness regulatory frameworks, because I just don't think they're going to – I think what's going to happen is we're going to wind up in court for a whole bunch of years, and I don't know that we will have solved the problems waiting for us on the other side of the horizon.
Do you feel that whatever Congress does, they're impotent against the vertical monopolies created by Facebook and Google and Amazon and Apple, and I'll add Microsoft into the mix, even though the government.
We don't have. So I've been fighting hard and lobbying for an office of what I call a National Office of Strategic Foresight. There was something called the Office of Technology Assessment, which Gingrich defunded in the 90s with his Contract on America. And the challenge is that left a significant void. And, you know, Ajit Pai, suddenly toying around with Section 230.
Oh, Lord.
No
legal basis to do, I might add.
Now, he and I were in a meeting on Thursday.
Really?
Or Wednesday, and in the green
chairman
room.
Chairman of the FCC. Yeah. Did you confront him?
Well, so he and I were speaking on a panel, and we were in the green room before that. And, you know, listen, the fundamental problem that we have is that these are all political appointees.
Right.
These are political appointments, and we technically have some frameworks in how long people have to stay in office before they can swing back into the private sector, but it never works out that way.
Right.
And what I think we need is some type of strategic office in place where people are in that space, they are highly educated, and their job is to fill, you know,
Yeah, but then, right now, then they're not accountable. The whole point of political appointees, in theory, is that they're accountable ultimately to the voters, right? If you have this some sort of strategic office that is just in there for life, who are they accountable to?
Not for life, but for very long terms. We don't do long-term planning in the U.S. And so the reason that I brought this up was because we're not going to solve the current, we're not going to solve the past monopoly problem using our current situation in a way that makes sense for the future.
Yeah, even the House report called for new monopoly rules.
I think that that's true, but incomplete, because I do think that there's a lot of space for our traditional antitrust remedies in existing competition problems. And one of the reasons I think that is when you look at the way the companies grew, you don't see the kind of exotic growth that is often spoken of when we hear about the tech companies. And we're told that they're large because of their network effects or their first mover advantage or something to do with, you know, longitudinal data sets or what have you. Instead, when you look at these companies, you find companies that by and large have grown through unlawful means that are unlawful under the plain language of the Sherman Act and the Clayton Act.
Anti-competitive acquisitions.
Yeah.
And leveraging their monopoly power in one market and in another and that kind of thing.
100%. I mean, Google is a company that has made, depending on how you count, 1 or 2.5 successful products, right? They made a great search engine, a good Hotmail clone. Maybe Android is something that was in-house because it was a camera OS when they bought it and then they fixed it. Right. And maybe Google Photos, but of course it comes bundled with all of their devices. So can we really, like if you have 1 billion devices and you pre-install Google Photos on it, is that a success?
Right.
But everything else that they've done that's successful was in-house, or rather was bought in, rather, and everything they've done in-house crashed and burned, right? Wave and Plus and Orkut and all of those other things. And so at least a first approximation, I think that it wouldn't hurt to try, not least because the
existing rules to attempt at least to enforce them.
Yeah. Yeah, not least because we see concentration in other industries. And when you pick at the concentration, it got there the same way. That's how pro wrestling became one league. It's how beer became two companies. It's right. How movie studios became four. It's how we ended up with one movie theater chain. It's how we ended up with three record labels. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's five publishers, all of this stuff. They all have the same growth pattern. And so there would be an enormous social benefit, irrespective of the specifics of the tech industry, to restoring a vigorous presumption that predatory acquisitions, mergers to monopoly, and vertical monopolies should not be permitted. And even the very muscular DOJ framework of the 30 glorious years, the post-war years, where if there was a 5-year period in which the structure of an industry remained static, where the company on top stayed on top, they would presumptively open an investigation into that company, because if you managed to stay number one for 5 years, you were probably up to no good, right? So that's like a good start. And I agree with Amy that this will produce long, difficult lawsuits, but they are a feature and not a bug, because what they do is they terrorize executives, right? That Bill Gates being humiliated on the stand and having that go viral really changed the calculus within Microsoft. And Microsoft insiders and chroniclers of Microsoft, and even Bill Gates' own account, suggests that the reason that the tech industry grew without the kind of stuff that Microsoft had done to Netscape in the years after the antitrust suit was in large part because they had lost their predatory instincts. Because whenever someone in the boardroom said, hey, let's go do something bad, the other people in the boardroom said, didn't you see what happened to Bill the last time they put him on the stand? Go wash your mouth. That was soap. And, you know, Bill Gates told Kara Swisher last year that he didn't buy Android because he was distracted by the antitrust. But that was 7 years after the antitrust.
Right.
What he meant was that 7 years later, he still had PTSD.
Terrified. Yeah.
And he couldn't bring himself to do it. But there is something about tech that is sui generis, that's unique, where we could bring remedies in, which is interoperability. And we have in the history of tech so many stories where tech giants were forced to reckon with competition and were forced to up their game or found themselves relegated to the trash heap of history because a new market entrant would come along. They had the Seven Dwarves used to interoperate with AT&T's servers. You had Microsoft doing the same to IBM. You had Apple cloning the iWorks suite. You had Google impersonating a browser and asking every web server in the world for a copy of every page it had, right? All of that interoperability where one thing plugs into an existing thing, irrespective of the wishes of the people who made it, and even if it gores their ox. And what we've seen in the years since monopolization is that the companies that relied on this have stripped future competitors of the same tools they used to grow, whether that's Facebook suing over enforceable terms of service after violating MySpace's terms of service, or Apple arguing for the enforceability of DRM laws so that no one can reverse engineer iTunes after they reverse engineered Microsoft's flagship products to make an interoperable version, and so on. Every one of these companies, you know, has gone up the ladder and kicked it away. And just stripping them of their legal power to block interoperators would go a long way, I think, to restoring some of the vigor that we used to get and force them to devote more energy to R&D, because Amy's totally right. You know, these companies with trillion-dollar valuations, if you add up all their capital and then you add up their R&D, you still get something like 15 to 20% of their total market cap. The other 80% is the expectation of the market that they will extract monopoly rents. That's what the intangibles are,
yeah,
right? And so, you know, we really do need to change that balance.
Is your concern, Amy, that the political arm can't really effectively act because of politics? You know, we have conservatives, yes, and on the one hand saying, well, the problem with big tech is they're censoring our speech. We have so they wouldn't sign off on the Democrats' proposals to break up these companies. The politics get in the way of a sensible solution. So is that why you prefer this kind of strategic planning committee?
Right. I mean, I'm a systems level thinker, so I tend to naturally think through many orders of, you know, so I think in terms of sort of many next steps in advance, right? So the challenge that I am seeing is if we continue down the path trying to break up, you know, with the rallying cry to break up big tech, the question is, how do you reverse engineer an outcome that is desirable, but that doesn't set us again on the wrong path?
Instead of solving the problem, you just create a bunch more monolithic behemoths.
Correct. You wind up in court.
That's what we did with the baby bells, in effect.
Interoperability, right? And well, but let's stop and think for a moment. You know, at that point, we were talking about telephony and what was then complicated, but not that sophisticated.
Not compared to this, yeah.
Telecommunications infrastructure compared to now,
right?
You know, when you look at a company like Amazon, which everybody has missed what I think is the most compelling story. And the most compelling story for Amazon has to do with the future of our health data.
They've been nibbling at the corners of that without overtly pursuing it.
Right. I dropped out of law school just before I was supposed to start. So I never went to law school. I'm totally unqualified to give my legal assessment on this. From my outsider's vantage point, you know, it strikes me that they have done an incredibly good job not overtaking any other market segment on their own in at least the health and medical and wearables data space, which means that if you try to go to court or regulate them, they're going to be able to prove that there are plenty of other competitors.
Right.
Challenges when you zoom out. And you see the constellation of how everything fits together. At that point, you know, yes, that is very scary to me.
Yeah.
But we don't have a legal mechanism to deal with something like that.
I don't
if we
think
chase
that's
the shiny in this direction. My concern is that 10 years from now, you know, I've been writing and talking about what I see as the all of our PIIs sort of morphing into to a single data record, which I call a PDR or personal data record. We saw Clear about a week ago, 2 weeks ago,
yeah,
make an announcement that it was going to be the arbiter,
right,
of your data.
We got all
right?
your biometric data already. Why don't we just can handle it from here?
Right. So it is concerning to me that we don't have, it is pretty clear why Google and Amazon are rushing in that direction.
Right.
So this is what I'm concerned about. I'm concerned that we get down in the weeds arguing about these other things when there are much bigger fish to fry. And when Elizabeth Warren entered the race and was talking so much about breaking up big tech, you know, again, I understand why this is important, but it becomes politicized. And then the people who, depending on their politics, are talking about these things, you know, the whole conversation becomes toxic.
So
somehow we have to be able to decouple
right.
the future. You know, we have to decouple these things so that we can solve the issues that are coming. We have to address, we have to like figure out these future problems that we're trying to solve and reverse engineer them so that we're exactly. so that we're on the right path going
That's
forward.
Why it would be a mistake actually for you to worry about the legal nitty gritty of this, because that's later. We need to first figure out what's our framework. What's our plan? What do we want to accomplish? And then at that point, it's a technical matter of what laws you make and how you implement them.
And this is where I go back to just, again, let me sing the praises of the OTA that got defunded by Gingrich. You know, the problem is that we do have, like, I can rattle off names of some very smart people at OSTP and at State, you know, and at the CIA, the Federal Reserve, but we don't have a central mechanism to do this type of long-term planning so that we have the ability to decouple the investigations and the regulatory frameworks and do some more forward thinking without politics intervening. You know,
I would submit yeah. that the real problem is where does this strategic thinking come from? In the past, Corey, you've suggested that it's up to technologists to push us in an interoperable direction, in a positive direction, because technologists are the one actually implementing these technologies. I think you've even said, you know, you guys at Google and Facebook, now's the time for you to subvert the dominant paradigm. Would you agree?
Well, in the sense that technologists today are in such demand, depending on their discipline and specialty, that there are some things that if they refuse to build them, they won't get built. Right. That's why the tech won't build it movement is so important. And you know, the reason their bosses are giving them kombucha on tap and massages on Wednesdays is not because they're big-hearted guys. It's because they're terrified that they'll go work for someone across the street.
This goes right and back so, to your protagonist in Attack yeah. Surface and the rationalizations that she had to put herself through to get her to do what she was doing.
Well, the origin story of so many technologists is I wrote some code and a computer did the thing that I specified yes. in my code perfectly.
Yes.
And then I gave that code to someone else and they could do it too without having to know what I knew. And so I could kind of project my will around the world. And then I found a network. And on that network, I found people who shared my point of view, my interest in a kind of society of mind where I wasn't a weirdo and where, you know, I could make common cause with other people, whether that's about my gender identity or my politics or what have you. And the idea that all of those people whose inciting incident or whose origin stories rests in the realization that technology could give them so much more self-determination and pluralism, where the power wasn't concentrated into a few hands, but rather anyone who wanted it could get enough power to do what it was that they needed to make themselves happy. And then they've devoted their career to taking that away from other people is, I think, a fracture line that's under-theorized and underexploited, right? That there is a natural constituency, and we're seeing it. We're seeing it, for example, in Amazon, where you have workers who became energized around tech work issues around facial recognition or around the climate footprint of Amazon, but who then found themselves in solidarity with Amazon warehouse workers
right.
and who said, you know, that these are actually elements of the same rule. And I think that we don't lack for legal tools to address some of these concerns. What we lack is political will, that the plain language of the Sherman Act, the plain language of the Clayton Act, they've never been repealed. It's the same law that was used to break up AT&T and Standard Oil and, you know, to prevent so many mergers. What's changed is that Ronald Reagan's court sorcerer, a guy named Robert Bork, who is kind of a predecessor of Gingrich, he was a Nixonite criminal who's denied a seat on the Supreme Court because back in the 80s, you couldn't get a seat on the Supreme Court if you were an illegitimate jerk, unlike now. and he had this ideology that we shouldn't pursue antitrust action unless you could show an immediate consumer harm resulting from anti-competitive conduct. But the language of the act is pretty clear that the reason that we resist monopoly is because monopoly itself distorts our policy outcomes. That even with an Office of Technology Assessment, which I'm 100% for, and, you know, Gingrich, the long list of things that we should hate Gingrich for, that's one of the ones near the top, you know, blinding the American Congress to its ability to understand technical issues at a moment in which those issues are very salient. That was an enormously short-sighted and terrible, wicked thing he did. But even if you know what the policy should be, making the policy happen is hard when there are monopolies who can exert pressure, right? Because they have monopoly rents, right? They have these profits, windfall profits, and they have a small enough group of executives that they can agree on how to spend them. That, you know, when there's only five companies, you can all get together and decide on what your lobbying priorities
really
should
be. It's really no coincidence that Silicon Valley has come to Washington, D.C. in the last 5 years. And mm-hmm. so, you know, they seemed to be apolitical in the early years, and they learned very quickly that was not the
absolutely.
Way to be. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, and, you know,
Go ahead, Amy.
I was just going to say, just on the subject of D.C., a lot of people don't know this, but Microsoft was actively poaching from state. They have a fairly robust corporate foreign policy group. Microsoft, yeah, I mean.
Look, every science fiction, dystopian or not, eventually ends up being about corporate government, right? The world is run by the corporations, not by government, by the people, for the people, and of the people. And it sure feels like we're headed in that direction. You know, you said we lack the will. I think it's even more than just lacking the will, Corey. Perhaps we have the means. Perhaps we could even gather the will. I think the biggest problem is a lack of agreement on what needs to be done.
And knowledge. Part of the reason is knowledge. If you listen, I like to play this game anytime I meet with a bunch of lawmakers, and I don't mean to throw lawmakers under the bus at this point, but the fact remains that if you ask any of them to explain what Amazon is, they cannot do it. They just can't.
So that's where an OTA or a strategic office would be very, very valuable. That was the intent of the OTA.
The problem is that the way to break up a monopoly, you know, you need teams of people working together, and part of the political will comes from, you know, strong leadership under incredibly difficult circumstances. And that is going to be that's going to be influenced by what people are saying, right? By the public. So we kind of have this vicious circle. And let's not forget, these are also all publicly traded companies who have fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders. So we also have an economic issue here. And I'm not saying at all that we need to protect shareholders at all costs. But there are financial issues at play.
Well, president wants to tank the stock market.
Right. And, you know, Microsoft right now, which doesn't get, whose name is not often evoked when we're talking about current monopolies. But, you know, Microsoft is one of the United States' most valuable companies.
Yeah.
And
well,
Apple
you forgive
get
me. This is
either.
This is why dystopianism rules in the long run, because I'm going to call myself the guy in the middle. You guys are operating in a much higher philosophic and level and a much greater understanding than I am. But most of us are just kind of feel at a loss, feel impotent in the face of all this. You're faced with giant corporations with infinite resources, a government that has completely different priorities, which either are consonant or inconsonant with yours, but nevertheless have nothing to do with these corporate conglomerates. You have tech people like us debating what should happen, what's going on. And you don't really, I think most people, I'm going to include myself, don't really know what's going on anyway.
But
so
I think
this is a challenge.
I think it's a willful ignorance and a learned helplessness.
Okay.
Okay. I was in Whole Foods just really quickly. There's a brand new Whole Foods that opened up downtown, and for reasons that are too long to explain, we went shopping there. This Whole Foods, I don't think, is intended for the general public. We were probably it was a crowded store. We were one of maybe two sets of shoppers who were shopping for themselves. I felt it was like I was in an air. I felt like I was in a warehouse. I was surrounded by people who were picking. They were pickers, you know, shopping off of shelves. It was eerily quiet. I felt like I was an interloper in some other. Okay.
You're one of the last humans that will be going in that store, I promise you.
Well, and so that was one of the more profound experiences that I've had in a year where COVID has shifted everything that we know about.
I don't think it's
life.
Willful ignorance. I think it's moving so fast. It's very hard for us. These conversations have been the meat of most of the shows we've done over the last 2 or 3 years. And I don't think we've ever come to a consensus about what should be done or how it should be done. That's amongst us. We're fairly like-minded people who have, I guess, a better understanding of technology than a lot of people, and we can't agree. Maybe you and Corey can agree. Let me take a break. I want to. There's no good place to interrupt, so I'm going to interrupt right now. Hold that thought, Amy, and we can pick up right where we left off. But I do have to take a break. I knew this would be a challenge. I didn't drink enough coffee this morning, and I apologize. I'm doing the best I can to keep up with two of the smartest people I know, Amy Webb from the Future Today Institute. She is a quantitative futurist, whatever the hell that is. But we just know she's smart, and we're so thrilled, as always, to have her. And the legitimately inspiring Cory Doctorow, who is not only a great novelist, works at the Electronic Frontier Foundation on competitive issues. So this is right up his alley. And together they are easily the highest IQ panel we've ever had. And the average, I'm bringing it down and I apologize, but if you just take them and leave me out of it, is pretty high here. Our show today brought to you by Express VPN. Every day on the news, there's a story about how technology, we're just doing it right now, it's creeping into our private lives. I don't like the idea of somebody paying attention to every place I go on the internet, of every place I surf. We know that there's monitoring going on. And one of the really good uses of a VPN is to encrypt what you're doing, not just so that guy in the hoodie in the corner of the coffee shop can't see what you're doing. We're not in coffee shops that much anymore. But even so that your ISP or your carrier can't see what you're doing. This is why you want to use a good VPN. Now, the thing everybody's going to make a note of this, you should think about it, that VPN now becomes a proxy for that carrier or that ISP. All the stuff that you put through your ISP is now going pass the ISP to the VPN service. So you really need to pick wisely. That's why I use ExpressVPN. They secure everything, my phone, my computer, my smart TV. I even can put it on my router to protect my entire household. That's a VPN that really works. And yes, you can trust it. Third-party independent audits of their privacy policy and their trusted server technology show that they do not log, they do not track, they do not know what you are doing. When you're on an ExpressVPN server, you're running in RAM on their trusted server technology sandbox, so it can't write to the disk, it can't log your activity, and as soon as you log out, poof, it's gone. It's gone. And that means there is no way ExpressVPN can keep track of what you're doing, which means there's no way anyone else can. It's easy to use, too. Fire up the app, tap the button, you're protected. In fact, it's the number one rated VPN provider on the market. If you just search, you'll see everywhere ExpressVPN is very highly rated because it is a good VPN provider that really protects your privacy. It's also really fast. They put the money into having many, many servers in almost 100 countries so you can watch HD video on ExpressVPN. You know, a lot of times people say, I don't want to use a VPN. It's going to slow me down. Not ExpressVPN. So much so that you can use it to watch video from other countries. Watch your Netflix in the UK and get all those Doctor Who series, or get your anime fix, your manga fix by watching Netflix Japan, just by pointing your ExpressVPN server to those locales. It's really kind of amazing. We've got a deal for you. Now, look, you shouldn't be using free VPNs. It's expensive to run a VPN. If they aren't charging you, there's another way they're making money. But ExpressVPN is very affordable, less than $7 a month. Take advantage of our best deal offer, which is a year of ExpressVPN plus an extra 3 months free. Go to expressvpn.com/twit. And if everything I haven't told you isn't 100% true, you have a 30-day money-back guarantee for 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. expressvpn.com/twit. Protect yourself online with expressvpn.com/twit. to it. We go back to the ring for round three. Actually, it's not a fight. There's a considerable agreement here, which actually encourages me. Amy Webb, Cory Doctorow, I interrupted you, Amy. I don't know. Were you able to hold that thought?
Yeah, no, it was a question. You were disagreeing, I think, with me / us, and I wanted to know what it was about.
Okay.
I think we should move on.
I have no idea. Well, I guess my only point was that for most of us, this is baffling, and I don't know what the solution is. And I certainly, if I don't, I don't expect government to come up with a great solution either. Where should this conversation be held? That's why I posed that question to Cory, because I think you're right, Cory. The people who are writing the technology, or creating the technology, bear considerable amount of responsibility, and we should encourage them to let their conscience be the guide. But who else? Where else should this conversation happen? Is it the EFF boardroom? I think even in the EFF boardroom, there's not a lot of agreement, is there?
Amy, you go ahead first.
I was just going to say, there's a certain amount of self-flagellation that's happening right now in the Valley, where it's become cool to talk about how bad everybody is.
Yeah. Just watch The Social Dilemma on Netflix, and you'll see an example.
So
of that.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And I find that fascinating. I find it fascinating that everybody's feeling great about.
Well, it's the easy way out. It's the easy way out. Guilt is the easy way out. Self-flagellation.
But it's not guilt.
It's as bad as blaming the other guy. It's just a way of abrogating your own responsibility, if you ask me.
But it's more than that. It is, it's a club. It's a, I don't know, Cory, maybe you know what I'm trying to express.
There's a lot of groupthink in Silicon Valley, isn't there?
But it's a, the cool kid, like it's cool now to talk about how what Silicon Valley has done is bad.
Right.
I don't understand how.
As if you didn't have anything to do with it. Yeah. As if
so. I it reminds me, there's a Yom Kippur joke, which I guess is very seasonal, which the rabbi and the richest man in town are praying at the altar on Yom Kippur. And the rabbi says, "Oh, Lord, I'm nothing. I'm nothing." And the richest man in town says, "Oh, Lord, I'm nothing. I'm nothing." And the janitor who's been cleaning the pews comes to the altar and says, "Oh, Lord, I'm nothing. I'm nothing." And the richest man in town turns to the rabbi and says, "Huh? Look who thinks he's nothing, you know?"
Yeah.
And I think that there is a humble brag the social dilemma self-flagellation, which is we geniuses turned out to be evil geniuses.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's no question about whether we're geniuses.
We're geniuses, yeah.
And I think that you know, if the critique starts with, look at these geniuses – then who have done this remarkable thing instead of this commonplace thing, right? The monopolization that was undertaken using tactics that are not so different from the tactics that Vince McMahon used to turn 30 wrestling leagues into one, and no one's going to call him a genius. Then what you're left with is, oh, look at these greedy mediocrities whose self-rationalization allowed them to take the digital nervous system of the 21st century and turn it into this brittle, anti-robust, monopolized, surveilling, compromised thing, despite the manifest dangers that gives to us as a species and a civilization.
Yes. I agree.
Right, Leo, that answers your question, because that analogy actually sticks really well.
Yes.
Because I think everybody feels like they understand wrestling, or at least it's approachable. I think that we have been made to feel like we can't possibly understand tech.
Yes, right? It feels hopeless. It feels like, if you guys can't figure it out, I don't. Why, how could I?
No, but having what would it take to have an informed conversation? It would take admitting, at least from the outset, that you're missing a critical mass of knowledge to have that informed conversation. Right. And nobody wants to be made to feel stupid. Right. Yeah. So I think part of what's happening, that was what I meant when I was talking about a willful ignorance. I think that we don't want to be confronted with our lack of understanding. And listen, especially if you feel as though your age means that technology and therefore the world are passing you by, you're not going to want to have an informed conversation. And so the easier thing to do is either to ignore it or to join in a chorus which feels right because you're politically aligned with whoever's ideology is shouting the things.
Yep.
So let me try framing this around a different policy dysfunction. Let's talk about lead in the water in Flint.
Okay.
So as far as I know, no one in Congress is a public health expert or a chemist or a biologist. I'm sure no one on the Flint Council is, and no one in the Michigan State House. Pretty unlikely if anyone in the Michigan State House had that background. And yet, for most of Flint's history, they didn't have lead in their water, and most other cities in America don't have lead in their water. And the question of whether and how much lead you should have is an intensely technical question, and yet it's one that they were able to answer without mastering the chemistry or the biology. It was one they managed to have by adopting an adjudication process, a truth-seeking process, by which people with rival ideas would go before a neutral adjudicator, present their evidence, and the adjudicator would make some empirical findings and then ask some political questions about how they should be interpreted. So like in the UK, when David Nutt was the drug czar, he had a panel of experts rate all of the drugs that had been scheduled as dangerous or not dangerous, according to how dangerous they were to the person who used them, to their family and to society. And then he came up with different models to see which ones of those drugs changed in their ranking as to how dangerous they were, depending on your political priorities. Some of them were always going to be very high on the list of danger. Some would always be very low, but some would move depending on your political priorities. And then he went to Parliament and he said, I have an empirical basis to answer your political question. If you have a political consensus that we want to protect society rather than users or families, then I'll tell you where these drugs go. And if you have a different political consensus, then I'll tell you where the drugs go on the basis of that. And so we can merge both the political and the empirical, but it requires that we have an honest process. And David Nutt was fired because he refused to say that cannabis was more dangerous than alcohol. And the alcohol industry in the UK, by its own reckoning, is only profitable because of binge drinking, unsafe binge drinking. If unsafe binge drinking were eliminated, that's where the profit margin is.
Oh, Lord.
And the drinks industry operates its own anti-binge drinking education program, which is very unsuccessful.
Yeah,
and they say
why.
It's unsuccessful because they can't fix it. And yet he created one that did fix it. He created a rival one. And when people were inoculated with this, they did less binge drinking. And in the background of that, right, where you have this very powerful industry that is very profitable and highly concentrated, the evidence was secondary to their ability to distort political outcomes. And that's why I think monopolies should be at the front of this discourse. And also,
the amount of lead in water is a very clear-cut and easily measured criterion. Is there something like that for the problem of big tech? Even to say the problem of big tech sounds reductionist.
Well, okay, retaining long-term data retention has no good evidentiary basis, right? I mean, knowing that I clicked a link 10 years ago gives you nothing except for compromise, unless it's like you're hoping to sell me a roof and the link was to a link to replace my roof
30
years ago.
So
the only reason to hold that is because hard drives are cheap and there's no statutory damages for breaches. So we know that like data that is collected tends to leak. We know that leaks have unquantifiable risks and that you should have a policy of data minimization and retention minimization. But that policy is not operated by any of the firms. Quite the opposite happens, you know, or like whether people like being surveilled for advertising. We know they don't.
So I make a bill that requires data minimization. You can hold the data for 3 months, something like GDPR, actually. Isn't that kind of what GDPR, the California privacy?
There are elements of it, yeah, for sure.
So I make that bill. First of all, could we make a bill like that? Could we get it passed? And if we did, would that be sufficient to solve the problem of big tech?
No, it would be an iterative
like
step.
It's a little tiny thing. Yeah, look at what a GDPR. All I know is I get cookie announcements every 5 seconds.
We are going to have an enormous problem in the United States. The more that our homes produce data and devices produce data, and the more federated these privacy laws are. And I'll give you a clear example. So Walmart has a product that it's been researching. It is not in market, but it is a connected shopping cart. There's a patent that they've won.
Yeah.
Basically, you put your hands on the shopping cart. Yeah. You go into a store. It is looking for it takes a biometric baseline. And then as you shop throughout the store, checks for anomalies. So if your pulse is racing, you're sweating a little bit more, the shopping cart knows. The shopping cart pings the store associate to hopefully help you have a better time shopping throughout Walmart. There are some tangible use cases that might make sense if you understand how those data are being collected and mined and refined and what that ultimately means for you. However, the fact remains that a shopping cart may not be able to cross state lines. A shopping cart may be more scary and illegal than a bottle of alcohol. And the challenge is that there are myriad devices coming to market that do the same thing. And we just don't have a clear understanding of what those data, how those data can be collected, by whom, and for what purpose. And the EU has been debating this. I was at a couple of high-level meetings over the past 18 months or so, and there are lots of global leaders and organizations with enforcement powers who are trying to define data ownership. But again, this to me diverges from the great story about lead in the water and big alcohol and big, I guess, or tiny cannabis. The challenge is that when it comes to questions about technology, where we have to have conversations regarding data, and the people who are having those conversations they can't explain or understand what it is they're talking about. You know, that to me is fundamentally different from having conversations about lead in water or blood alcohol levels. I mean, you don't have to be a doctor to have a basic understanding of a toxin in your body.
I don't think we can
have a modicum of.
Yeah, we can't even identify what the toxin is very well in this big tech. I just feel like
I don't know. I think you guys have got that you're engaging in the sin of a subject that is not your, assuming that the subject that's not your discipline has relatively clear-cut lines and little debate within it. I guarantee you that within addiction research, there are enormous debates about what amount of alcohol is safe, what frequency of alcohol use is safe, what the danger signs are, and so on. These are, in fact, hotly contested issues all around, as is the question of, like, how much lead can be. I mean, there is going to be trace amounts of lead in your diet, right? That's a fact. So how much lead is too much lead, and what steps do we take, and what's the cost benefit?
Can we agree here?
All of those are contestable.
Can we find a common ground then between the three of us on what we should do about big tech? I like data minimization. I think that's good. Oh, I know we agree.
I agree with Corey.
Let's get the framework.
What I'm saying is, I think we need to project much further out into the future, because we do not tend to create policy or regulatory frameworks. NIST doesn't work on norms and standards. We don't have processes in place until there's a problem. And at that point, we're trying to fix or levy punitive. It would be much better if there was a way to incent the different parties, which in this case are big tech, also the market, so investors, also everyday people and the government, to come together and collaborate. I know that sounds pretty naive, but I do think that I think that pursuing something that incents tech companies to put their work, to reframe their work as a public good, or at least a lot of that work, it doesn't lead to the loss of revenue necessarily, and it does allow us all to plan for the farther future, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, some of this is just corporate reform altogether. You know, Amy mentioned the fiduciary principle, which, you know, traces back to this Milton Friedman editorial. And the problem with the fiduciary rule for corporate governance is that it has no empirical benchmark, right? So, like, I could say it was my duty to put lead in the water of Flint because we only paid a $1 billion fine and we made $1 billion in $1 in profits, right? Or I could say it was my duty to engage in a string of predatory mergers without regard to what might happen in the future. Or I could say I had to exercise forbearance and not engage in any predatory mergers, lest 5 years down the line, this provokes so much anger among regulators that they broke up the company in a way that cost us more than we would have made, right? I had to hire that person because doing so created new efficiencies that could have led to new business. I had to lay that person off because the cost savings could go to my shareholders. There is no course of action that cannot be framed as beneficial to shareholders if you get to name the time frame and assign your own weights to hypotheticals. And so I think that the shareholder rule has always been a sociopath's charter, right? Just a thing that lets you do greedy things and insist that it's your legal responsibility to do them. And that a stakeholder rule, which is, you know, closer to like the German proposition, the stuff Varoufakis is pushing these days, is a lot closer, where at least what you say is, okay, well, there are competing priorities. There is no one empirical answer. We tend to rely on multi-stakeholderism as a way of resolving them, right? Rather than saying, okay, well, we'll just trust bosses to have their workers' best interests, we put the workers in the room too, so that at least they have to come up with a thing that where they can swing enough votes or find a compromise to govern the company in a way that accounts for both of their interests. So, you know, the stakeholder model has environmental regulators, consumers, workers, bosses, and investors all in the room, all with a seat at the table, all with what amounts to board votes. And it produces an outcome that at least gets a look in from other people's priorities. I don't think that it's necessarily good, but I think that is a necessary precondition for something being good, that you'll never get something that's good for all of those stakeholders if one of them doesn't get a seat at the table.
I think that that is largely correct. And I would also just add that I think companies, it's my observation that companies are a little shy, a little gun shy, I hate using that word now, a little concerned about doing risk modeling and incorporating more voices because they're concerned about the future of legal action. And there's a very large company that has some smart people working with it that I talked to a couple months ago that wanted to do some longer term risk modeling to figure out how could they mitigate some, you know, problems that they were likely causing having to do with the environment. And we were all positioned to do that work together, and their legal department shut it down.
Yeah.
And they shut it down because in the United States, if word ever got out that this company was engaging in work to fix the future, they were doing a lot of what Corey just explained. Their legal department was concerned that would open them up for some kind of big tobacco style lawsuit at some point.
Yeah, you knew.
And so
you knew,
right,
sir.
Right. So they were, from their vantage point, it was less of a problem to simply do the bad stuff and deal with it later on than to have sorted out how to fix the problems that plausibly were being caused in advance, mitigate that risk, and then you know, do things a little differently. And the very fact that we are so litigious, and that the fact that somebody is concerned about being sued 10 years from now is going to prevent them from doing the risk modeling that would create a better outcome for everybody. I mean, to me, that is absolutely unforgivable.
You could do it, but just don't write any of it down. Just remember.
Well, okay, so
don't take notes.
Let me frame that slightly differently and say, what if the countervailing force was not to deprive people who've been harmed by companies of their right to legal redress, but rather to make the penalty for not taking action to address your pollution so dire that the risk of litigation 10 years on because you show that you had actual knowledge and didn't take action on it. I mean, frankly, I think that's an overblown risk, right? We have Exxon's memos, right? Exxon knew 30 years ago that they were going to render the entire planet uninhabitable for the human species and took no action on it. In fact, the only action they took was a disinformation campaign to bury the facts that they knew, that their own scientists had told them. They're in litigation, but it's not like that litigation has a hope of going anywhere unless there's some real shifts in how we proceed. Yeah. So, like when I started at EFF, our legal director is now our executive director, Cindy Cohen, was engaged in a lawsuit called Bowoto that she brought with her from her old firm when she came to EFF. And she was representing Larry Bowoto, who's the sole survivor of a massacre in Nigeria by mercenaries hired by Chevron. Aye. And she was suing Chevron in a U.S. court on his behalf, civilly, and its directors and officers. The case collapsed when all of her key witnesses were assassinated.
Oh, nice.
It didn't moderate Chevron's conduct, right? Like, so I guess I would be more sympathetic to the plight of companies who are risk averse because of the risk of litigation if the Sacklers weren't saying to their pharma reps, you know, go find me the pill doctors and give and reward them for pushing pills on people in ways that are dangerous but increases our profits. There are so many firms. Sure. Go ahead.
No, but before you move on, I just wanted to, and I don't mean to interrupt, but I think there's an important point to be made right now. And that is in industries where there has been tremendous consolidation of power and bad things happening, I just want to note that they're very different. So the Sacklers pushing, you know, highly addictive medications on people, I think is different from some, and again, I'm not defending Chevron, some of the things that have happened with Chevron, but I would also say that those big oil and petroleum companies tend to work with local regional offices.
That there is a direct parallel between the Sacklers pushing addictive narcotics on physicians for prescriptions is not so very different from, say, YouTube pushing addictive algorithms to keep you watching more YouTube videos, or Facebook adjusting its news feed to keep you stuck to Facebook. There is a certain similarity between the two.
Right. So Corey made a really good point that I loved, which was, can't the punitive measure for not doing something in advance to yeah. mitigate the risk?
Yeah.
Can't that be a more compelling outcome than the opposite?
What about just doing the right thing? How about that as a motivation? You know, well, I know we're exposing ourselves to potential lawsuit in 10 years, but you know, this is doing the right thing. Maybe we should just do that.
But again, like we're in a situation where the nothing incents that. And in fact, if anything,
but that's our problem. I would submit that's the problem right there.
Right. So Corey had a really great suggestion, which was, can't we make it so that the threat of a lawsuit for ignoring.
It's hopeless. If you're going to use government incentives to get people to do the right thing, it's hopeless. Because look at the tax code. That's government incentives trying to get people to do the, quote, right thing, depending on what party's in power and what legislators are writing the laws. That's hopeless. If people aren't going to do the right thing, because they're not legally incented, we have real problems. We have a moral gap.
It's true, but also, you know, think about the microeconomics of a room in which decision makers have gathered, and they have different priorities and different urgencies about how much they need the money and how much they care about different priorities. You can make a moral pitch compelling if it comes with an instrumental pitch, right? If it's both. You know, this is an argument that comes up a lot in the torture debate.
Yeah. Mm? The carrot and the stick.
Yeah, I mean, this comes up in the torture debate, right? On the one hand, torture generally gives us bad intel. But, you know, when I raised this with Bart Gellman, who's, you know, one of the Snowden journalists, he said, well, torture gives you bad intel, but if I've got like a safe and I need to open it and I can tie you to a chair and go after you with a pair of tin snips, I'm going to get into that safe. So there's another reason we don't torture. It's not just because it gives us bad intel, it's because it's wrong.
Right.
And both of those things being true, bad intel and it's wrong, is more powerful than either of them on their own. And so, you know, I think in respect of the boardroom, you know, look at the Americans with Disability Act. I think it's a really good example of how you can blend both the moral case for accommodating people of varying abilities. And, you know, as my friend Liz Henry says, we are all of us only temporarily able-bodied. And so, you know, you're really only benefiting yourself when you create that norm. But also, we created a regime with stiff damages and a loser pays system that invited the no win, no fee bar to show up and say, like, were you discriminated against? I will sue them. The deeper their pockets are, the harder I will sue them because the more legal fees I'll get back. And I will pray that they drag out the case and try to bankrupt you because that's just more fees for me. And so it created a different equilibrium.
I would agree. We don't want to create incentives to misbehave, but I don't think incentives not to misbehave can replace a moral compass.
I just think that replace is the wrong word. I think augment.
Augment.
Right? Like,
okay.
Like, how do you, you know, it's so. So
we probably should eliminate the incentives to misbehave for sure. Let's eliminate.
Sure.
Let's eliminate those if we can track those down. Let's get those out of the legal code. But I don't know. I mean, I'm starting to sound like a preacher here. We really have to have a moral compass. All right, maybe you
okay,
can.
Okay, but who's?
Well,
okay, but here's the problem.
Any moral compass would be better than none.
I don't know that I agree with that because
this is part of the
challenge that we keep running into is whose morals, whose worldview. Because,
yeah, but quite frankly, we have an amoral situation where corporations are not incented in any way to act morally at all. Their entire organization is to maximize profits, regardless of whatever ethical considerations there would be. And I don't know if you can teach Sundar Pichai or Satya Nadella. I would guess Sundar Pichai and Satya Nadella and maybe even Jeff Bezos have some sort of moral code. But maybe that is the problem, is that the incentives are all there to make a money, to your fiduciary responsibility, to your shareholders, stakeholders, overwhelms whatever moral code you have. I don't know. Is that the problem?
What is the goal then? What would be the replacement goal, right?
Well, I understand.
And then how does
you and I may differ on some of the details of what's right and wrong, but I think at least in the Judeo-Christian world, we have some sense of what direction would be good and what would not. You disagree?
I think, again, if we're talking with this level of ambiguity, we're probably all on the same page. I think that the challenge comes when you have to make a decision on the fly in that moment.
I agree that there isn't going to be a perfect litmus test, but you would tend the arc, as Martin Luther King said, the arc of history would lean towards moral justice if...
Sure.
You know, it wouldn't be perfect. We might disagree on the details, but it would tend toward moral justice. It does not seem to be tending that way. It seems to be tending towards profit, greater profit.
Well, we also don't allow people to change their minds. Listen, the whole Earth catalog, you know, Stuart Brand had, you know, has changed his mind over the years about lots of different things. Some of those early tech visionaries changed their mind.
What would you
I'm not
say?
Talk his... about what he believes.
Okay.
What I'm saying is,
evolves. I understand it changes and evolves. Yeah.
And so, if we're talking about the strategic direction of an organization whose products and services ultimately rely on our data, that to me, that's what all of this comes down to is data. The fact that Apple has launched a financial instrument where the traditional ways of making money on that instrument, i.e. a credit card, is not through the transaction.
Right.
In fact, they make no money on that transaction, which tells us what? That the data are more valuable to this organization than the transaction
Isn't
itself.
Isn't that fascinating?
Which upends, yeah. Right. So we have to ask, so therefore the question that we have to ask is, who should have the right to those data, under what circumstances,
and the
answers to those questions, I think, are a little challenging.
So let's start there. We all seem to agree that's a good starting place. It may not be 100% of the problem, but this issue of the data, our data, there seems to be consensus, right? That this is one of the big problems big tech is imposing on us. Let me take a break. And then we'll come back and discuss this. And I want, now, Corey, you're a California voter. Amy, you're not. I don't know how well.
Oh, I'm a Canadian, so I'm,
oh,
I'm
you
a
don't
California
get to vote?
Bystander.
Oh, so, well, you can
I
tell
voted
me.
A month ago.
I did this week. But there's a proposition on the ballot. California has a very aggressive privacy law, but the guy who wrote this originally, it's a complicated story, had made a deal. Alistair McTaggart, a good Scots name, had apparently made a deal with the California legislature that if you pass this law, I won't put my proposition on the ballot. So they did. He has now come back, and it is back on the ballot, Proposition 24. I don't know if you've read up on it. I'm just curious if this is this Consumer Personal Information Law and Agency Initiative, is a step in the direction that you two can agree we need to make. Or if GDPR is, or if the current California privacy legislation is. I actually have a lot of people asking me about Prop 24 and what I think they should do. I can tell you I voted for it, but there are, but it is just like lead in the water and binge drinking. There can be a definite diversity of opinion on this thing. So I would love to talk about that. And yeah, maybe we can narrow it down to let's talk about the data. What do we do? I mean, there's Tim Berners-Lee has an initiative. Is it NRUPT to somehow contain our data and control it so that we can then sell it off if we wish to or not, somehow mine our own data for our benefit instead of for the benefit of these big tech companies. Maybe that's a solution. Let's talk about solutions when we come back. Right now, though, I want to talk about our sponsor, ExtraHop, the new IT reality, pretty obvious, remote access on a massive scale. Of course, we're seeing rapid cloud and even multi-cloud adoption. And all on top of a steady increase of Internet of Things devices and rife cybercrime. It's an interesting environment if you are managing a cloud enterprise. It is an interesting place to be doing business. In this post-compromised world, it's more important than ever that organizations can see everything going on in their environment, from the cloud to the data center all the way down to the customer. But in order to prevent an incident from becoming a full-scale data breach, you need more than just the information, more than unified visibility. You need context for your detections and then intelligent response workflows so you can act quickly, teams can collaborate, you can get the job done. And that's what ExtraHop is all about. ExtraHop stops breaches 70% faster. ExtraHop eliminates blind spots in your business and detects threats other tools missed to keep you secure and available with SaaS-based cloud-native network detection and response. They really were originally all about performance monitoring, but they realized, hey, you know, we're monitoring the performance. We can also monitor threats. And that's when things really clicked. Threat detection and response in the cloud, on the network, tool consolidation so you get the information you need and you can act on it. Here's some examples. Wizards of the Coast uses AWS Cloud, and they use it with ExtraHop. Their chief architect and information security officer, Dan McDaniel, said, and this is the quote, "There's no other company that aligns to supporting our DevOps model, the speed and the lack of friction, than ExtraHop." Ulta Beauty, you've probably seen them in the mall. They use ExtraHop to secure their Google Cloud, as well as to keep networking and security teams closely aligned so engineers have more time to focus on innovation. Their senior IT engineer, John Kreese, said, quote, "Before ExtraHop, we had limited visibility to what was going on in the cloud, but now we can quickly identify vulnerabilities and exploits and understand how our applications are performing in the cloud." You've got to see the demo. It's on the site, extrahop.com/twit, to get a sense of what ExtraHop can do for you. And look at all the companies that use ExtraHop. The ability to see what's going on, to see the threats, to respond coherently, effectively, in a timely way to whatever's happening on your network. This is the key. ExtraHop.com/twit. You'll find out how ExtraHop stops breaches 70% faster. There's a free trial there and a complete demo so you can see the ExtraHop dashboard at work. ExtraHop.com/twit. This is a tool you want to use. This is a tool you want to know about. If you are managing a complex multi-cloud environment, if you've got customers out there, if you've got data in here, you got to have ExtraHop. ExtraHop.com/twit. All right, I figured I'd give you a minute or two to read Prop 24, word for word, and give us, I already voted, so you can't influence me, Corey. What do you think? I know you're a Canadian. You don't have to worry about this stuff.
Well, there's two different parts to it, and I'd be interested in what you're more interested in. The first is like the pluses and minuses of 24, which, like you, I've had a lot of people ask me about. And then the other one is this idea of whether putting prices on data will solve the data issue. But right. I can answer
question.
Either or both, but yeah. You tell me what you're more interested
well,
in.
Well, you know, the controversy over 24 Well, one of the things McTaggart, the reason McTaggart came back to the proposition, and we have, it's kind of a broken system in California that really comes from a legislature that prefers to stand back and let democracy take control. It's fairly easy to get these propositions on the ballot. You only need to collect a small number of signatures, which can be easily done if you've got the money to do it. So we get all sorts of kind of oddball, conflicting propositions, but even kind of disingenuously worded propositions. So poor voters in California, and this might be true in other states now, have really got a challenge ahead of them to read these, to understand what they do. We have a very good California Consumer Privacy Act, but it did apparently cut out, you know, some carve outs for some companies. On the other hand, people have complained that Facebook had a hand in writing this ballot proposition. So this was their way of saying, we're protecting you. It's impossible. It's really impossible for the average person to figure this out. Given the amount of time we have and the number of propositions we have to vote on, I often wonder if this is a system that's got any hope.
But which would you like to know about? Would you like my views on 24?
Yeah, start with 24. We'll get to NRUP next. All right.
So 24, the history of this is that the first time around CCPA was passed. It was passed in somewhat in haste. It had a few defects.
They were really trying to get the initial proposition off the ballot 2 years ago.
Sure. That's right. And then what I think from its backers' perspective was more disturbing was that it then became the target of just an endless slew of reform bills that would have made it worse, not better, that were heavily financially backed. And I think that they were dismayed at the thought that they were just going to have to spend the rest of their lives babysitting this bill and staving off this kind of attack. And so the ballot initiative, the new one, creates a requirement that the bill not be amended except in furtherance of its purpose, which on its face sounds like a good way to avoid that kind of skirmishing. But the people, so I've been in the middle of people who I respect who are really ferociously disagreeing with each other about this, who are normally on the same side.
That's what I suspected.
So I have been taking these arguments, right? The person who tells me, well, you know, the furtherance of the original purpose solves that problem, to people who are skeptical of it. And they say, well, except that the way the bill is worded is it says to promote the competitiveness of Californians and the privacy of Californian people and the growth of California's economy and fundamental equities.
So everything fits the purpose.
So like, what is in the purpose, right?
Right.
Well, I mean, there are lots of bad faith answers to that. But the question is, how much time do you want to spend litigating it?
Right.
So rather than spending all your time in Sacramento lobbying over it, you might spend all your time in the Ninth Circuit litigating over it. And it's like, it's six of one, half dozen the other. And the idea that you make legislation that is bulletproof and that no one can come along and amend.
That's just a bad idea on the face of it.
It's a lovely idea if you support the legislation's
yes.
ends, but it's not.
It seems a recipe for disaster.
It's wishful thinking.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think that 24 makes some compromises that I wouldn't make. In particular, there's two things that I'm concerned about. The first is that it doesn't have a private right of action. And that means that if your rights are violated, you have to convince like an attorney general to bring a case on your behalf. And the thinking was that there was no way the California Chamber of Commerce and other big business lobbies would allow this to pass unless private right of action were stripped from it. Because once there's a private right of action, they're worried about so-called nuisance suits. I think that that's a pretty grave defect. And then the other grave defect for me is the I just blew my buffer on what the other grave defect is. That's the big one.
It should tell you something that the people against Prop 24 include not only the Republican Party, but the Green Party, the Libertarian Party, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers, Dolores Huerta, the ACLU, the League of Women Voters. They don't want it. But then,
so I don't want to say, I don't want to counsel you to vote against it because I am thoroughly on the fence about it.
I know.
And I remember what the other thing was, which is that it, there was the thinking of the backers is that if it had a default to privacy where you had to opt in to have your data collected instead of opting out to not have your data collected, that this wouldn't pass First Amendment muster. And there are some First Amendment litigators I know who say that's wrong. And there are people with a good track record of litigating difficult tech-related First Amendment questions. And so I'm not a lawyer, I'm not a First Amendment lawyer, and I'm not a litigator. And so I'm left with these people. Normally the way that I resolve these issues is like you. I find a technical expert and I who I trust, and I ask them for their judgment. And generally the pool of technical experts I rely on agree in the main. And this is an area where they're very split.
Right.
And I'm, you know, it's one
that's
of the few
by the
times
way, why
I'm thankful
I, asked you.
I don't get a vote.
That's why I asked you, Corey.
I understand.
And you have not helped me.
I had a local candidate for our city council ask me this morning how he should vote.
I just want you to know, I supported your candidate for the Texas Railroad Commission.
Good. She's amazing.
I sent her some money.
Me too.
This, Amy, in case you weren't familiar with this, I can't remember. I think you might have mentioned this, or maybe I read something that you wrote.
T. Boone Pickens' old lawyer.
Yeah. T. Boone Pickens' lawyer? That's who she is?
Yeah.
That's funny because, weirdly, in Texas, it's the Railroad Commission that decides whether oil wells can burn off the natural gas. You've seen it all the time in movies, these flares coming off of the oil wells, which of course is a huge pollutant, a major contributor to greenhouse gases. And it's the Railroad Commission that decides whether you can do that or not. And she could turn the entire Texas Railroad Commission on its ear and stop this practice of flaring.
They would basically have Texas's emissions. And the commission is structured so that it requires consensus to grant a permit, so one person can block it. It's a three-person commission.
Amazing.
It's this amazing race. Yeah,
I'll be watching that race. You wouldn't think I'd be watching the Texas Railroad Commission race come November 3rd. But
so I'm interested in what Amy has to say about Prop 24.
Yeah, so, and you're not a voter in California, Amy.
No.
But and probably haven't been following it that closely. The reason it's important is as California goes, so goes the nation. It's a big enough economy that if California has these strong privacy laws, just as GDPR really influenced everybody in the world, it would very much influence United States companies, especially those who operate in California. So it's of importance not just to those of us in California, but to everybody.
Yeah, but I guess I would put that within the context of what does the House and Senate look like and who's in power over the next, you know,
the federal government.
Well, here's why. We continue to have these. Listen, or maybe we should just make up our minds.
You can't do it state by state. You're saying you need a federal law.
All I can tell you is Amazon has a wristband out called the Halo, which listens to you all the time. And, you know, it's not quite a Fitbit. It's not quite an Apple Watch. This does some of the same things, but it also scrapes your biometric data to make inferences like, are you feeling hopeful right now? Right. And are you exhausted? Things like that. You know, there's ambient noise that gets picked up on the other side.
Yeah, you're wearing a microphone all the time. When you say, hey, a word, but all the time. Other hand, it works so poorly. I've talked to people who've used it.
It doesn't matter. The use that doesn't matter to me. That doesn't matter. What matters to me is how do we manage consent in a multi-state system where we've got state by state laws that differ?
Yeah, but Amazon's never going to make something that you can't sell in California.
Right. So what you're saying is that if this passes in California, then every other state's privacy goes in the same direction. I don't think that's the case.
I think it would impact companies that would like to sell a product if they know that just as California's California's emissions laws affected the world.
It did. But even GDPR is managed differently country by country in the EU, and those the enforcement, and that's really what I just whacked myself on the face with my own microphone. The real question comes down to enforcement. And GDPR is enforced differently within countries, within parts of countries where you've got different local agents interpreting things differently.
Okay. So, by the way, I just tricked you guys.
Okay.
Because we've said all along, there's a solution. There's a solution. There's a legislative solution. There's a governmental solution. Here is a possible solution, and neither one of you can agree on whether that's a good idea or not. I don't understand how, but I don't understand how we can even hope for a governmental
solution. I want to hear Amy's other solution.
Okay, what's your other solution?
So a couple of years ago, I was trying, I'm always trying to think through, like, I understand what the problems are. How do we, like, what's the most clever solution?
I like that.
So
that's rarely, by the way, the calculus. It's usually more, what can we get politically? What can we get through? What can we write an ad for? So what the most clever one is often the one that gets passed by.
Right, the cool thing everybody wants to talk about, all the government leaders are talking about data ownership as though that makes sense. But what would it take for there to be data ownership? Anyhow, so here's what I have been mulling. What I've been mulling is for a while. So Alaska has, the state of Alaska, if you live in Alaska and if you are a resident, I think you have to have been born there. Norway does something similar. You get sort of a basic universal basic income dividend check from oil. And my thinking was, we have a social safety net in the United States that's going to collapse. And that was true pre-COVID. And we have long-term medical, the medical needs of people who are aging are not going to be met. Also true before COVID. So is there some way that we can solve some of those problems while also solving the problems of data? And where I came back to was, if it's the case that all of our PIIs are at this point increasingly being consolidated by just a few companies, wouldn't there be a way to consolidate, not all of them, but a lot of them, such that they were anonymized, but available and permissions could be given as needed? So I was thinking, is there some kind of blockchain?
So that's interrupt. So now we've moved to the second part of Corey's question, which is, all right, and I agree with you. Maybe the clever way is, I don't know how you would enforce that though, Amy. How would you make that work?
Right. Because if my thought was that with every, let's call it a packet transfer for the sake of conversation, that there, any time that anybody's data were monetized, that there would be some way, some fraction of a cent, that would go back to the individual, and the individual would have the ability to determine how those data were being used. And again, this is a thorny, challenging issue because there are so many, how would you define data at that point? But, so anyhow, my idea was that this does a couple of things. One, it forces more data literacy and more technological literacy, which I think is a good thing. Two, it helps solve some of these future social safety net issues, which are coming and we are not prepared for. And three, it potentially incents the big tech companies to do better because it avoids avoids what they're currently facing and forces them to give up a little bit and forces the market to give up a little bit, but not in a way that's going to cause anything to crash. So that was the idea that I had been playing with. And it seemed as though a DLT, distributed ledger, which would give everybody the ability to make some of those decisions, would also force them to have to come to grips with what data are being collected in what ways.
Fair. But how do we convince Facebook and Google and Amazon to adopt this DLT?
Well, hang on. I think you're getting ahead of the ahead of the game here by starting with let's go ahead with it. I'm skeptical of the. I think maybe we found the area where Amy and I disagree. With all due respect, and I understand where, I hope I understand where you're coming from, but I think that there are a couple of pretty important flaws in that proposal. The first one is the idea that we can have clear title to personally identifying information. Most of the most valuable PII is in relation to other people. So the fact that you are your mother's son is a fact that in theory both of you own. Right. And that at the same time, your father probably has some claim over as well. And that I might know as an unrelated third party. And so the idea that we could have a market in which we either arbitrarily assign clear title to one of those people, which you could imagine incredible dysfunctions, right? What if your mother owns the fact that you're her son? And that means that you can't post on Facebook about how she abused you as a child, right? Or your former boss has clear title to the fact that she's your former boss or he's your former boss, and you can't warn other people about the workplace conditions because they own that fact, right? So this is the first problem is we have this blended ownership that doesn't lend itself to market transactions to begin with. And the second problem is that if we acknowledge that privacy abuses are themselves harmful, we do not want to make some social good contingent on their expansion, right? It's like funding cancer research with tobacco sales. The best thing for cancer would be for tobacco sales to be eliminated. We do not want the cancer research industry in some way reliant on increases in tobacco sales. We want to decouple those things. We were talking before about incentives. I think this is a very powerful poor incentive. And Ed Felton, who used to be the CTO or deputy CTO of the Federal Trade Commission, and was in the White House Office of Tech Policy, and is late at Princeton, he talked about this once in an article where he talked about interests and about how when we talk about human life, for example, we don't create property rights to regulate it. And in fact, creating property rights in human life is kind of the mark of sociopathy, right? Murder is not theft of life. Murder is a crime unto itself. We have a whole language of describing it. And for that reason, we also have a language of describing our relationship to one another that's not grounded in exclusive rights. You know, my daughter and I have a relationship to one another in which I have an interest in her, and she has an interest in herself, and her school has an interest in her grandparents, my wife, who is her mother, her friends, and many other people all have varying degrees of both legal and ethical claim to her because she is sui generis. She's a human and in no way like a thing that we make markets in. And I think information, person identifying information, is much the same. And that so much of the dysfunction that we have arises from the fact that PII is not amenable to propertization. And then finally, I worry that although it would be great to have more information literacy, that you would mostly get information fatigue, that having to understand all of the different transactions that you opted into just by moving through time and space would create a kind of nihilism. And that you would end up with privacy as a luxury good, where the wealthy could afford the professional class who would help them navigate that. And everybody else would just be opted into adhesion contracts where all of their data was harvested non-consensually with the pretense of consent and abused without limit.
Right. So privacy is currently a luxury good. I don't think we should kid ourselves or try to convince ourselves otherwise. It's those people who both have knowledge and the financial wherewithal to use tools and systems to prevent others from tracking them. It is that group of people. It is the wealthy who have the ability to be anonymous or to be private as they need. So I think that that's an addressable issue, but I don't think that that is so meaningful, right, with this argument. Now, in terms of all the PII, I don't think that we are, and Corey rightfully explained, I don't think that tracking every single piece of this makes, you know, feasible or logistical sense. That being said, my favorite parlor trick is having people go to Google and open up their locations. And the number of people who have absolutely no idea just how much they're being tracked all the time, to me, means that we are creating future problems for ourselves. So
out of ignorance.
My husband is not, my husband, I'm married to a really successful guy.
Yeah.
I remember sitting on the couch with him just after our daughter was born 10 years ago. He had something open and I was like, hey, you want me to show you everywhere you've been for the past, you know, whatever. And I pulled that open and we didn't speak for 2 days.
What? He was pissed?
He was, there was nothing wrong. I think it was just this crushing sense of having not known that.
Right.
And this is a highly educated person. So I think we need to decouple the education and understanding of how technology and most importantly our data work from the business of sorting out who owns and has access to those data and how they can be used. And while I totally agree, we can't incent the companies to force us to create more data in order to earn more revenue, if that's the direct, if that becomes a, a feasible UBI, because then we all game the system and then the whole thing collapses. My point was, I think that we are moving in this direction anyway. I believe that PII are quickly morphing into what, again, I call a PDR, which is personal data record, which is sort of one-stop shopping for all your stuff. I know that Salesforce has started to lay the groundwork when it comes to health and education. I know we all know what, you know, Google, Apple, and Amazon are doing some of the same things. You know, wouldn't you rather have a non-commercial entity housing your data in a way that is less icky? And I think the answer to that is yes. And if we are doing, you know, because to me, this seems to be an inevitability. And again, why I think we ought to address some of these, the future plausible problems that we're going to be facing at the same time that we deal with the current issues around monopolies that we face today.
I feel like if in a country where we can't agree whether a mask causes COVID or not, we're going to have a lot of trouble getting a consensus on what privacy is, what companies should be allowed to do. Honest to God, most people would rather we were talking about the iPhone 12 than this, because it feels hopeless.
They
either don't care or it's hopeless.
Listen, no, I think they do. Sorry, go ahead, Amy.
I was going to say, I think if everybody cared as deeply about privacy as the journalists do, I think we would see significant behavioral shifts. So
is that where we start, is getting people to care?
I don't think we do get people to care. I lived in Japan for a really long time. And the way that you say the word privacy in Japanese is puraibashi. There was no word for privacy.
Right.
I'm not making this up.
No, privacy is a fairly modern concept.
Well, it's a very modern concept because of modern technology in Japan.
Right.
They never had to talk about it before.
Right.
And, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is I just don't think this fascination that this fetish, you know, we almost fetishize, I think, privacy at this point when we talk about it. But we just, our behaviors don't mirror the conversations. And I don't think the everyday person, I'm on the IRC right now, or the IRC channel, and you know, some of the same questions are being asked there. I don't think the everyday person cares so much about how they're being tracked, or if they do, the conveniences of the systems that they're using are so overwhelmingly positive that they are happy to give up that privacy in exchange for the convenience of having access to all that.
They may be faced with that crux even in Japan, because Japan, India, and the Five Eyes governments, which include the U.S. and the U.K., have all called at the Five Eyes meeting for backdoors in encryption. It's essentially the U.S., the U.K., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, and India agreeing that end-to-end encryption is a threat to national security.
National security?
Yeah.
Well, from their point of view, it is.
I guess, yeah.
Well, I would love to kind of take a step back and talk about people's revealed preferences in privacy. So that the widest adopted consumer boycott in the history of the world is tracker blockers. 1 in 4 web users worldwide.
Isn't
a much
that interesting? That's a very good
right?
point. I don't know if that's about privacy as much, Corey, as I just don't want to be slowed down. I don't want to see the ads. I bet you that's half the reason.
Well, I mean, it's hard to disentangle, but there's certainly an awful lot of it. And one of the things that we know from the GDPR experiment, which has gotten us some facts and evidence, is that if you serve first-party context ads instead of third-party behavioral ads, more of your ads get through the blockers that users choose, about twice as many. So users are choosing the kind of blocker that blocks third-party behavioral ads, but not first-party context ads. And those are the privacy-invasive versus non-privacy-invasive ads.
Well, so I only do first-party contextual ads, as you know.
Right.
But I have to say that's probably more because it's easier technologically to block third-party ads than it is to block
first-party
ads.
But you also get, I don't know about that, but you also get twice as much money because you don't have to give a VIG to the ad broker when you're doing first-party ads. The other thing is that the most successful challengers to social networks have been privacy forward, right? So Snap, for example, was the most successful challenger to Facebook. They were only able to defeat it, ironically, by spying on users with a deceptive fake battery monitor called Onavo that spied on how people were using Snap and replicated Snap's functionality in Insta. Snap's pitch was, we're like Facebook, except your data doesn't hang around. Ironically, Facebook's pitch for its first 10 years was, we're like MySpace, except we don't let Google index it or third parties see it. It's private.
Right.
Right. Facebook built its fortune on being the privacy forward network. So I think that it's true that people tend to underweight the future costs of privacy disclosures because it's hard to understand the connection between a privacy disclosure and a future harm. But people retrospectively regret privacy disclosures when those harms arise.
Right. Yes.
And so you could say that people like smoking because we have a lot of expensively sown doubt about the relationship between tobacco and cancer. And the only people who are angry about tobacco are dying of lung cancer.
Right.
And now it's too late. Right. But it actually turned out that that when we prohibited firms from lying about the harms of their products and when we instituted vigorous public education about those harms, that the public's consciousness shifted. The same is true of climate. Right. There, the revealed preferences of Americans is we want trucks bigger than God. And we don't care how much dinosaurs we have to pour in the gas tank. But when you ask Americans, how do you feel about your red sky, the hurricane, the invasive mosquitoes, the refugee crisis? None of them are going to say that that was a good bargain for their SUV.
But then it's too late.
Right. So this is why I think you see journalists and activists who are ahead of the public consensus.
Yeah.
Because what they're trying to do is reach the point of peak indifference before the point of no return.
Yes.
And, you know, if peak indifference only arises after you've got a lung full of tumors, then you might as well keep smoking and enjoy it for the years you got left, right? And if by the time you care about crashing animal populations is when there's only one rhino left, we might as well find out what he tastes like because he's not coming back. So this is why you have an activist cohort that tries to lead the consensus.
Right. What do you think? I think that sounds about right. Amy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I
wonder how we do that.
I don't have anything substantive to add.
I guess we're in the activist cohort. So is it our job to come up with better and more subversive propaganda to achieve our goals? Maybe do some advertising or write a book. How about a book called Attack Surface? What about that?
I mean, I try to achieve.
That's what you do.
What
is that what you're trying to
achieve necessarily through argument. I mean, it's just another way of presenting the argument.
Yeah.
You know, Orwell gave us 50 years of being able to head off all like abstract policy discussions about surveillance by saying, stop being so Orwellian, you know, and that I think is the thing that art can infuse our policy discussions with.
It's funny that we should come down to that because ultimately that's what art is about. And that is what artists are about. And futurists. I imagine futurists have a little bit of that going on, too. Our show today brought to you by Wasabi. Not the green stuff on your sushi, although delicious as that might be. I'm talking about Wasabi hot cloud storage. It's the perfect solution. If you're a company buying more hard drives all the time, more local storage, what are you doing? What are you nuts? If you know, we need another terabyte this week, next week, and every week, or a petabyte a month, or whatever it is, you should be going to the cloud. You should be going to Wasabi. First of all, you might say, well, wait a minute, what about those other guys? No, Wasabi is a fifth the cost of Amazon S3. It is significantly faster. It's so affordable, it actually will cost you less than the maintenance fees of the on-prem storage you're looking at buying. Less than just the maintenance fees. And I would argue it's more secure, it's more reliable than anything on premises. 11 nines of durability. 11 nines, I don't think you get more than that. They're hosted in premier tier 4 data centers, highly secure. They're fully redundant. That's good because Wasabi has active integrity checking. Every object stored on Wasabi is checked for integrity every 90 days. If one bit goes missing, no problem. These are redundant data centers. Remember, we can get the data back. You're never going to lose, not even one bit. It's secure by default. Even if you don't request it, all data is stored, encrypted at rest. They follow every industry best practice for security models and design. They have things like access control mechanisms, bucket policies, ACLs. My favorite thing is your data is immutable. You can say, I don't want this data to be erased or altered by anyone. Bad guys, malware, even me. Obviously, you could turn that off, but the malware can't. That is a great feature. That's why I say Wasabi's better than on-prem storage. Not just less expensive, but actually better. HIPAA compliant, FINRA compliant, CJIS compliant. And it's a flat rate. There's no weird tiering system like on S3. It's just basic, a basic flat $5.99 per terabyte per month. But they've even got a better way to save. They call it reserved capacity storage. If you are in the situation where you just know, I know I need a certain amount every month, you can buy ahead. You can reserve capacity ahead. Purchase storage in 1, 3, or 5 year increments. You'll save more for more storage and for a longer term. And it's a great way to get that price even lower. Wasabi is not just highly secure disruptive technology that's turning the industry on its ear. It's storage that's 80% less expensive and 6 times faster than Amazon's S3. Oh, did I mention no charge for egress? It always gets me with S3. Oh, it's cheap to store it here until you want it back. Then they're going to charge you. No charge with Wasabi. Egress is free. So is API access, and their API is 100% compatible with Amazon's S3. You're going to love Wasabi. Just calculate the savings for yourself. Just go to wasabi.com. Get a free trial of storage for a month. Use our offer code TWIT, if you will. Let them know you saw it here. Join the movement. Migrate your data to the cloud with confidence. Go to wasabi.com. And again, don't forget the offer code TWIT. And thank you, Wasabi, for supporting This Week in Tech. Thank you for supporting the show by using that TWIT offer code. That'll let them know you saw it here. I love having both of you on. Amy Webb is a futurist, quantitative futurist or qualitative. I can never remember.
It's quantitative. I work with a lot of data and build models.
Big data. Future Today Institute is her company. By the way, go there. It's so much fun. That front page, better than refrigerator magnets. Look, play with the various trends. See how it's changing the world. And of course, her book, which is well worth reading. I can't wait to read the new one on biotech.
Thanks. Yeah. But, I'm pretty excited.
But The Big Nine is an excellent book. Go ahead.
It's not about German refusal.
No, not that I know of. Can I just say one other thing?
Yes.
So we open sourced all of our research and our methods and tools, and we give everything away for free. So in all honesty, if any of what we have said tonight has sparked any interest whatsoever, the most important thing that you do from here on out is act. And you can, the smallest act is to simply go chase down some of the things we talked about and learn more.
Learn.
But you can also model next order impacts, and you can use the tools that we've got on the site to do that.
Or show your husband all the places he's been, then watch the
film. His friends all listen to this little hacker group that's on Keybase that I keep talking about.
Did they go, by the way? Are they still on Keybase?
They're all around, and I'm sure on Wednesday.
When you find a replacement for Keybase, will you call me and tell me?
I haven't found one yet.
They got bought by Zoom. I don't want to use them anymore.
I don't know what to do.
Cory Doctorow is also here. Don't forget, it's too late for the Kickstarter, but don't worry, because you can go to craphound.net. Is it craphound.net?
.com.
Craphound.com and get yourself the audiobook or a hardcover. I bet you even sign those hardcovers before you send them out.
So actually, if you go to attacksurface.com, which is a domain I didn't own, but which a reader just gave to me out of the blue, which is very kind of them, I'm doing a virtual tour, 8 bookstores, 8 nights, with different guests every night. And it comes with signed copies. In fact, if I had the lights on in my office and turned the camera around, you'd see the mountain of boxes of books that I am signing and fulfilling for the authors. So the four that remain, there's Bruce Sterling and Chris Brown talking about cyberpunk and post-cyberpunk on Monday.
Oh, I'd love
Emily
that
Newitz
one.
And Ken Liu on Tuesday. Tochi Onyebuchi and Bethany C. Morrow talking about young adults and revolutions on Wednesday. And then we finish with Runa Sonvig from the Tor Project, who used to be the frontline defender for the New York Times newsroom, and Wendo Snyder, who's a security expert. She was a very senior cryptographer at Apple for many years, started at Loft Heavy Industry, was in Cult of the Dead Cow.
Oh, wow.
And the two of them are talking about practical personal cybersecurity.
Now, are
and
you
so
there too? So you're...
Oh, yeah, no, it's me and them. And they all come with signed copies of the book. If you want to go to more than one of them and you don't want 2 copies of the books, if you go to craphound.com, you'll see a list of bookstores or rather of libraries and prisons and halfway houses and classrooms and universities that will take your copies.
Nice.
And so you just put their address down instead of yours, and I'll sign it to them and mail it to them instead.
Wow. Well, if you like this conversation, these are going to be even better. This sounds really great. This is great.
That's an amazing lineup
kidding.
Of people. It sounds
Thank you. Yeah.
Really, really good.
Attacksurface.com.
I had last week, you missed Malkias Cyril from Media Justice and Meredith Whitaker, who led the Googler uprising and founded the AI Now Institute.
Wow.
I had Amber Benson and John Rogers, Ron Deibert and Eva Galperin. The videos will eventually all be released and there'll be a podcast.
I was just going to ask you, where can we go to
podcast.
The date's not announced. Different bookstores have different policies about when they want the video embargo to, but we will make them all public.
Nice. What a good idea. How much better is that than a book tour? So much better.
I don't know. I miss being crammed in a fart tube and having given my morning government genital massage.
Those were the days, weren't they, Corey?
Good stuff. Yeah, mini bar cashews.
Nothing like them. Let's take a break. We're not done. I still got some more time. I know you have to get to a birthday party. Is it your daughter's, Amy, or?
No, it's mine. It's my birthday today.
What?
Happy birthday!
What?
Yes. Ooh,
it's
Mazel tov.
My birthday.
That's awesome.
And I am here with you.
That's awesome. Happy birthday.
Thanks.
So are you going to have a party after the show?
My birth date. What's that?
Are you going to have a party after the show? Or is your husband not talking to you still?
No. We're all talking. We've got literally nowhere else to go, so we have to talk
to each other.
My daughter made me a little something, so I'm going to go retrieve it before bedtime.
Thank her for letting us have mommy for so long. I really appreciate it. That's really happy birthday, Amy.
Thank you.
That's my fantastic. Wife calls me her cellmate.
Yes, I feel that. I'm joking. No, I listen. I am grateful to be.
We're working.
Space.
We're alive. We're with friends. We're eating. I mean, it could be a whole lot worse, and it is for so many people. And that's such a tragedy.
Actually, can I give a plug for my birthday? I am raising money for local food banks everywhere. So this is me telling you that food insecurity is a real thing all around the world, but also in the United States. Even in seemingly affluent communities, if you have $5, $10, whatever, find yourself your local food bank and please give them money. That's what I'm doing.
Couldn't agree more.
You just reminded me I haven't made my monthly donation to the Burbank Temporary Aid Center, so I'm making that right now.
There you go.
Thank you. That's awesome.
Wow, you guys are great. We're going to take a little break, come back with more. Do we have a promo for this week? We had a good week on Twit, and John is going to push a button now that will show you exactly what you missed.
Today, we're bringing 5G to iPhone. 5G, 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 5G,
5G,
5G. And 5G is going to unlock even more opportunities for
our developers.
What
does 5G have to do with a camera?
5G, 5G, 5G.
Verizon 5G.
Well, there you have it. The 2020 5G iPhone 5G event from Verizon iFi, 5G Apple Campus on the 5G.
Previously on Twit. All about Android.
Got Juan Bagnell in to talk the new Pixel 5, Sony's new Android phones, and the latest Tick Watch.
I think from the Pixel 4a to here, it's definitely a step up. The 30 frame per second 4K looks phenomenal.
iOS today.
You know, it's getting a little, the water is raising in the studio here. So if you just don't mind, we can finish this up. Oh, God.
Hands on Android.
And you thought that Samsung's devices couldn't get any more customized. Well, Samsung has an app called GoodLock that you want to check out. It'll take it even deeper, and I'm going to show you how to use it next.
This Week in Google.
Google's giving data to police based on search keywords.
Oh, crap.
If you get caught up in something like this, what happens to you as a citizen? What is the burden put upon you to prove your innocence?
But somebody like DuckDuckGo, that's their selling point, right? We de-identify. We don't know who you are. I hope that's true.
Is that where you're doing your fertilizer bomb searches?
Twit. Unbelievable as always.
5G.
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 5G. 5G. 5G. 5GE.
5G.
5G. 5G. 5G. 5G.
5G. 5G. 5G. 5G. 5G. 5G.
Birthday girl, Amy Webb. Yes, I didn't even talk about hiding your light under a bushel. Whatever that means. Corey, are you Jewish? You keep saying Jewish things. I don't think Doctorow is a Jewish name. What is that?
Doktorovich.
Huh? Doktorovich.
I was raised by atheist Jews. I went to socialist Yiddish school.
Oh, there you go.
I speak terrible Yiddish and am irreligious. I once at my wife, who is not Jewish's insistence, did a Passover Seder where I bought anarchist Haggadahs and replaced every instance of the word God with a vast, uncaring universe. It makes for a very good Seder.
You know what they really love is when you replace the word Israel with Palestine. They just,
I replaced it with just two-state solution.
Yeah, two-state solution. They love that. I know. Yeah.
Who's the they? I am Jewish.
the chosen people, you know. I bet you use a pretty liberal Haggadah, I would guess.
We are gastronomically Jewish. I don't know. This whole thing.
You like pastrami, but, you know, you don't drink milk.
I like pastrami.
Yeah.
I feel politically disenfranchised and... religion's a tricky one.
I don't know about the religious part, but culturally, I wish I were Jewish. It's the best.
Did you hear Corey's joke about the Yom Kippur?
Yeah. Well, there you go. That just said any religion that has its own jokes, that's great. I love
There's
that.
like 5 million of us left, I think, on the planet.
Is that really true?
No.
There's a
shocking few number of people.
There were 6 million killed in the Holocaust, and there's only 5 million left.
I think there might be 11, but there's by
that's worse than the rhinoceroses.
There's very, very few of us left, and I think increasingly
is that because of assimilation? Is that assimilation and secularism that's
I think that's probably part of it. You know, and just I have one child. I mean, it's not like we're
you got to get going.
You gotta make the kids.
And you named her after an Arab landmark.
I did. It's so controversial.
People are saying, what, the Blue Mosque? What do you call her?
Her name is Petra.
Petra.
Her name is Petra.
One of the most amazing. Have you been to Petra, Corey? Did we lose Corey? His signal is...
mic problems. Yeah, how's my mic?
Now it's okay. It got bad for a bit. I thought it was a bandwidth issue. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, my kid is Jewish-ish. She asked for Rosh Hashanah off, and I said, if you spend least 2 hours this morning researching what it is and what it's about, then you have it. And she did, and I gave her the day off school. Yeah.
That's nice.
But, I think it depends. It all depends on how you count. I think one or both of you may know Rael Dornfest, who was at O'Reilly for many years and then at Twitter. And when we first met him, I was at an O'Reilly event. And Tim O'Reilly was there, and Rael and I told each other Jewish jokes for about 20 minutes solid. And Tim was both aghast and amazed and said, what is this? And Rael totally straight-faced said, well, it's the J2J protocol. When two Jews meet, they have to exchange all their Jewish jokes to synchronize.
That's awesome.
And
oh, my God, that's amazing.
I love it.
That's hilarious.
The best thing, we just had Sukkot. And do you build the little...
You built a Sukkot?
I didn't.
I'm a little confused.
I have friends who did, but I think it's the cutest thing ever. I want to do that. They built a little hut.
We don't have time for context. And if we start talking about some of our...
I know, it's going to get weird.
I think people are going to get...
Yeah.
I think there's... It's not going to help me and myself and our cause.
One of the things, though, that the Jewish faith really embraces is an intellectualism. And one of the things I was thinking when Corey was talking is, and actually both of you, is what we need is something that we used to have in the United States, they still have in Europe, is this notion of a public intellectual. Public intellectuals who bring up these issues, who talk at this more lofty level, and really kind of can frame the political conversation. And right now what we have is just lots of yelling and conflict and nobody rising above the fray. I feel like that's something that is kind of missing from our discourse in this.
Intellectualism has a little bit of a challenging past.
We've always hated this in
Jewish
America.
Yeah. People.
Yeah.
Let me just say this. The thing that, so my family came to the United States. They were escaping like everybody. And I grew up around people that had numbers on their arms from concentration camps. The thing that I learned that a lot of people that I know learn from a very early age is that, when they come for your, you know, they can come and take your things,
yes,
but they can never take away your education. And so education matters more than almost anything else. Education and hard work. And if you have learned things, and you are willing to work harder than everybody else around you, then no matter what happens, you'll be okay. So I think those are good values. I live by those values. Education is more important than anything else. So we make sure our daughter knows stuff. But there is a little bit of a line with the sort of intellectual, you know, the Jewish intellectual trope is real prevalent in propaganda all around the world. So it's a
bad thing.
It's a double edged sword.
It's a double edged sword. Okay. Well,
I will tell you. The Forward is a Jewish news organization, mm-hmm. and I got voted one. They make a list every year of the hottest Jewish intellectuals, and I was on that list. And, which I kind of thought was like funny. And then I realized like this could potentially be a problem later on. And I worked kind of hard to bury it.
Oh dear. Yeah. Were you worried about anti-Semitism?
Yeah. My college roommate was pretty, horrifically anti-Semitic and got expelled for doing some pretty bad stuff. You know, it's the year 2020. We have a president in office who is unabashedly racist and anti-Semitic, anti a lot. It's plausible that he won that election because of those views. And there is no question that there's a rise in, you know, there's a rise in public displays of anti-Semitism and racism and anti-ism. And I guess we're kind of circling back to where we began, which was Corey's, I think, admonishment of just awful dystopian futures and dystopian fiction, because it reinforces some of those beliefs. And I guess I kind of agree with that. I'm changing my mind from where we started.
I guess, when I think, I'm sorry, Amy, I didn't mean to interrupt. I thought you were done. Sorry.
No, go.
Please. Oh,
I apologize. It's the Skype thing. Go ahead, Corey.
I just wanted to say, you know, my father came to Canada on a DP boat, and when he got to Canada, he was racialized. He was spoken of as someone who was of a race that was not white, right? Right. And he was
from Russia. He was a Russian.
His father was Polish and Belarusian. His mom was Russian.
Okay.
And he was born in Azerbaijan. And by the time I was born, we had become white, right? In terms of the way that we appear in the discourse. And I look around at family members and friends of mine who, like Amy, experienced firsthand the horrors of violent industrial scale racism, and who, upon attaining whiteness, decided that their allegiance lay with the system that divides us into white and not white, and not with opposing racism everywhere. And I feel like what we're learning now in 2020 is what we should have intuited, which is the last people who get pulled into the whiteness boat are the first ones pushed over the gunwales when the seas get stormy, and that our allegiance as people who are descended from and part of a culture that was shaped by this horrific, violent racism is to be aligned with anti-racism, especially especially opposing anti-Black racism and the xenophobia that is directed at people from Central and South America. And, you know, I'm proud to the extent that I see Jews remembering that in their history and making that their lesson. I dismayed to the extent that it isn't as universal as I would hope it would be.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be a mistake for us to deprecate intellectualism. I think we have done that. Going back to Adlai Stevenson, who was declared an egghead and not elected president, that's we have a long history of that in the United States. But I think maybe we need smart people more than we did ever before, and we need people who are willing to think big thoughts and be public about that and talk about that. And both of you are my models for this. You're both so eloquent and so smart, and Amy, the forward was right. You're willing to step out and talk about it. And I thank you for doing that, especially on your birthday. Amy Webb, Future Today Institute, The Big Nine. Can't wait for the new book. Can't wait till you come back and be on the show with us. Did you hear there's a new iPhone? Did you hear that? Did you hear anything about that? Because I heard that happen.
I heard the 5G is back.
It's back. It's 5G. It's fine.
I've been told that.
Thank you, Amy, for being here. Have a happy, happy birthday. I really appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thanks. Thank you.
Cory Doctorow or Doctorovich or what? I like
Doctorovich.
Doctorovich. I liked it.
Yeah.
It's always a pleasure. Cory's new website, pluralistic.net, he has a great newsletter, which you should subscribe to. He is if not eclectic in his interests and tastes, and it's all reflected at pluralistic.net. It's the way a blog used to be.
I have an appreciation for a new Apple product as well, since we're going out, which is that I was very delighted to see that they finally introduced a product for dad jokes, the eye roll.
If only.
I stole that joke from DJ BC of the Beastles.
Give him credit.
It's a good joke.
The eye roll is here. Actually, they did introduce a scented candle that talks to you. So that's pretty cool. And it'll even follow you around. Sometime we'll get down to the privacy marketing that Apple does and how accurate that is. I have to say, some of the smoking gun emails that came from the House Judiciary Investigation, the Antitrust Subcommittee, were pretty damning of Apple. I think as much as we'd like to think of them as the shining fruit on the hill, it's not quite the case there. But that will be
There are a lot of Uyghurs who don't have VPNs anymore who are pretty skeptical of Apple's privacy claims.
Exactly. But that's for another day. We are done here. Pluralistic.net, craphound.com. Don't forget, by the way, to get your autographed copy and go to those virtual readings. That's really cool, really exciting. What's the website for that again?
AttackSurface.com.
AttackSurface.com. There must be a fee for those because you're going to get a book, right, for the readings?
Yeah, it's the cost of the book plus a couple bucks for shipping. That's the ticket price.
That's very fair. And that's virtual, and it's all online, and there are a few more still to come. We haven't missed them all. There's one tomorrow on the 20th, the 21st, and the 22nd. Boy, these sound like great conversations. Thank you, Cory. Happy birthday.
Thank you, Amy. Happy birthday, Amy.
Yeah.
Thank you. And, hey, the new book is amazing, so congrats.
Yeah. Oh,
thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'm really looking forward to reading your next one. Synth Bio is definitely a subject near and dear to my heart.
Really interesting.
I'm really looking forward to finishing it.
Yeah.
On my deadline.
Good luck with that.
Those days long gone for me. Thank God. That was a nightmare. We do Twit every Sunday, about 2:30 Pacific, 5:30 Eastern, 21:30 UTC. If you want to watch or listen live, we do have streams at twit.tv/live. But honestly, there's no reason for you to disrupt your Sunday evening. You can easily just get the on-demand versions, which are available on our website, twit.tv. There's a YouTube channel. You can watch or listen there. Best thing to do would be get a podcast application and subscribe. That way you get the every episode the minute it's available of a Sunday evening. Thank you all so much for being here. My brain is swelling. I'm going to have to go get a cold compress and think about what we've learned today. Another twit.
He's amazing.
Bye-bye.